Well, let's begin by hearing a little bit about David M. Parsons. He's been the recipient of a National Endowment for the Humanities Dante Fellowship to the State University of New York, the French American Legation Poetry Prize, and the 2006 Baskerville Publishers Prize from TCU for an outstanding poem published in their literary journal, Descant. He holds 6 writing awards from Lone Star College System and was inducted into the Texas Institute of Letters in 2009. Parsons grew up in Austin, and after graduating from high school there, he joined the United States Marine Corps Reserve, where he served as a squad leader in a rifle company and later as a recon scout boat team leader. He attended the University of Texas and Texas State University, where he received a BBA. After several years in business, advertising, and coaching basketball and baseball at Bel Air High School, he studied poetry with Stanley Plumley in London, England, after which Parsons entered the University of Houston Creative Writing Program, receiving an MA in Creative Writing and Literature. Dave Parsons' first collection of poems, Editing Sky, was winner of the 1999 Texas Review Poetry Prize and recipient of a 2000 Violet Crown Special Citation. He teaches creative writing and kinesiology at Lone Star College, Montgomery. Interesting combination, right?
Yes.
So the kinesiology part of what he's doing there is racquetball and handball. And we'll get to a poem that's related to that. He is founder and co-director of the Montgomery County Literary Arts Council Writers in Performance Series and chair of the Greater Conroe Arts Alliance. Parsons has 4 grown children and lives with his wife Nancy, an award-winning artist and graphic designer in Conroe, Texas. We'll meet her in some of these poems as well. His website can be found at www.daveparsonspoetry.com. I have some additional biographical background material in that handout for you, so it's a little bit different and a little bit additional information there. So let's start with our first poem, Orange County, April 29, 2005, handout page 3. And when I refer to the handout page numbers, it's the handwritten number. Orange County, April 29, 2005. It is Friday, and though I am over 1,000 miles away, I can see you clearly in the East Texas morning, rolling away from my vacant side of the bed to your feet, as you are compelled to do every early morning, moving militarily through the mechanics, creating another day. The first call of the toilet, shuffling to the kitchen, water for the kettle, the daily doling out of the medicine to the white countertop, the orbiting shuttle to our sleepy daughter's bedside for the exchange of her pills, for the small dog curled resistantly warm under their covers. And there you are, there between the oak tree and the row of dogwoods, doing dog duty on your birthday. What are you thinking today? If I were there with you, I would not know. Behind the physical, the mundane, there is the wonder, the mysterious and unique impulse that resides in the essence of you, the creation of stunning art out of the dark world of your haunting subconscious. I have rarely been able to guess those memories, those thoughts. Even if I were on that common quay, my face inches from yours, falling, plummeting dizzily into the auburn-framed countenance of your glowing presence, tripping into the folds of your graceful, familiar form, fixed in wonder on that onyx centering in the greyhound blue eyes, where that ineffable chalcedonic entity resides and in some oblique way takes dominion of all that surrounds.
Sounds like a song, sir.
That's a good way to sum it up. Yeah. So where is he? We don't know, do we?
Orange County, California.
Yeah.
Orange County, Florida.
There's not an Orange County, Texas, is there?
I don't know, but he's 1,000 miles away, so.
He could still be in Texas.
He could. So he's at a conference or some meeting. He's away on his wife's birthday.
Happy birthday.
Because it says.
Where is it?
Doing dog duty on your birthday.
Oh, okay.
I think he means she's taking the dog out to let the dog relieve himself.
I like his reference to color down in that one section of the poem, but it's used, they're used in ways that we generally do not think of them being used.
I'm not finding the reference.
Saying like the onyx centering the gray.
Oh, yeah.
Gray and blue of eyes. We usually say looking into the vast of your blue eyes or something.
Uh-huh.
The onyx to me is very solid. And then the word centering makes it more solid. And of course, the author, there's just a reference to author, which is auburn framed countenance of your glowing presence.
He's pretty hung up on her.
Yeah. It was nice just learning that his wife was an artist.
Yes.
The creation of stunning art out of the dark world of your haunting subconscious.
He's very proud of her, and she appears in several of his poems.
But to me, the dark world of your haunting subconscious means that there's something about her he doesn't understand.
Right.
He doesn't know about it. Maybe he doesn't want to know about her.
And he feels he never will. There's something about her that he'll never figure out.
That would remove the mystery of her.
He seems to want her to possess some kind of mystery for him, doesn't he?
Chalcedony is a stone, right?
Yes. Yes.
What does it say?
A translucent to transparent milky or grayish quartz with distinctive microscopic crystals arranged in slender fibers and parallel bands. It's Latin, chalcedonia is from Greek, a mystical stone. A mystical stone. That's probably why he's because she's mystical.
Here's another meaning. Chalcedon, an ancient Greek city of northwest Asia Minor on the Bosporus near present-day Istanbul, an important Christian ecclesiastical center. It was the site of an important ecumenical council, AD 451, which met to resolve questions concerning the nature of the incarnation. Could that also apply here? Because of the way he worships her almost?
That's probably warm, so yeah.
Yeah, I
like
that.
The spirit, kind of there's her spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's describing her.
Yeah.
And it also refers back to the greyhound blue eyes and the onyx. It mm-hmm. sounds like a new description.
Mm-hmm. But the mystery and the idea of the person he doesn't understand goes along with the Chalcedonia idea.
But she has some power, and that's what he worships in her, even though he doesn't fully understand it. Now, this italicized phrase in the final line, takes dominion of all that surrounds. Does that ring a bell? It's italicized. That's kind of a hint that something else is going on. Well, There's a very famous poem by Wallace Stevens called Anecdote of the Jar. Does anyone know that poem? Anecdote of the Jar. All right, here's the poem. I placed the jar in Tennessee, and round it was upon a hill. It made the slovenly wilderness surround that hill. The wilderness rose up to it and sprawled around, no longer wild. The jar was round upon the ground and tall and of a port in air. It took dominion everywhere. The jar was gray and bare. It did not give of bird or bush like nothing else in Tennessee. Now, there's a lot about this poem that's obscure. Wallace Stevens is not an easy poet. But this line, it took dominion everywhere, I think that Dave Parsons is alluding to this famous poem by Wallace Stevens, because just as the jar gives form and meaning to the wilderness around it, however that's supposed to work, his wife takes dominion everywhere, right? She
And a jar is a container. It's a symbol for femininity. Mm-hmm. Ancient.
Yes. Do you buy that? Do you think that this last line?
My wife runs everything in the world.
Okay.
I don't argue with her anymore. Yes, dear.
So, intertextual allusion. Yes.
No, I'm just going to say, I've been around conferences, and so I know this is kind of an idealized, but when you're really missing somebody, you really think of all the very, very best qualities. When they're there, you're not caught up in this kind of language, but when you're away, you really do feel this longing, and you do kind of see them in the best light that you've ever thought of them in. I think he's tapping into that here.
You can imagine him writing this poem from his hotel room or wherever he is, miles away.
He's just talked to her on the phone. He just really misses her.
Yeah. Okay.
The interesting thing would be to see him do an opposite poem where she's gone and he's at home.
Written by whom?
By him.
By him, okay.
To see how he feels having the house to himself once he's gone. Would he be missing her?
I often invite my students to write response poems where, they'll take a poem that I've assigned and they want to write a response to it by exploring a different angle somehow. So that's my assignment to you for next time.
I'll get in trouble for it, but I'll do it.
Okay. Bring it with you, please. Our next poem is called They. It is on handwritten page 4 of the handouts. Now that we know that Harry has Alzheimer's, we catch ourselves wondering out loud about our own memories, searching for that small void in our understanding of time's continuum. This cruel wound that delicately, as some evil surgeon, unseals the mute gray bindings that hold ineffably the inventory of a life, stuns us again and again with horrific wonder, leaving us with facial expressions not unlike his, as he turns his bent spade again and again, like some blind farmer, through the rough weed-filled furrows of recollection and recognition. At the garden cafe, Ruth, stately still, Rotley asks him in that wifely way, "Would you like tea or coffee, Harry? Harry, do you want tea or coffee?" Then the realization, oh, give him tea. An acquaintance happens by the table, and Ruth graciously, dutifully introduces her to Harry, who, as always, smiles affably and responds, "I am not really here, you know." Later, I accompany him to the men's room, where he becomes confused and begins to wash his hands before entering the small dark stall with its endless roll of blank white sheets of paper. Standing before the sink, he stares with what appears to be rapt erudition into the mirror and whispers in that familiar, gentle, fatherly tone, he wants to come back, you know. He wants to come back. And they won't let him.
Oh, that is so sad.
Wonder why he entitled it to faith.
The split cell numbers, he's there and he's not there, so there's two people.
Well, he's quoted at the end saying they won't let him. Strange that he's referring to himself in the third person. But apparently that's part of his condition. I don't know enough about Alzheimer's to comment on that. Does that strike you all as believable?
He's not too far down if he says, knows that something has happened to him.
At least so
that he used to be this person here, and he's no longer that.
Uh-huh.
He's not too far regressed.
Well, if he wants to come back, then he can. Obviously, somebody or something or they are stopping him. I mean, in his own mind.
Yeah.
So,
no one's preventing him from doing anything.
No, but that's his way, it's his understanding of his illness.
Right. So in an interesting sense, the title of the poem, They, refers to him and his condition.
His illness, I think.
Because the poem's all about him, it's not about they. It's about his condition that causes him to blame them.
It's probably a personification of the illness that he feels inside of him.
I'm wondering why this is important. You could connect these sentences and make it into a short story. I mean, it kind of looks like a poem, but if you read this, it's a short story. It's not a poem. That's
the perennial question, Wilhelm. You know, when you have free verse that doesn't insist on a rhyme scheme. So what makes this a poem?
You called it a poem. That's why it's a poem.
A rhythm? I don't know.
I want to say it's a poem because it digs into the expression of the face, the description of his mind, this is the face, digging through the garden. You know? It's not physical, it's literal.
A blind farmer with a spade isn't going to be of much use. And so you picked up on an interesting metaphor here that I think helps establish this as a poem, Wilhelm. There's a concentration here, a condensed presentation of what it means to have Alzheimer's. I think that's one way to talk about free verse as poetry as opposed to prose. So yes, you can string all of these lines together and make it look like prose, but he has deliberately presented it in poetic form with an unvarying two stanza format and enjambment that spills over from one stanza to another in order to establish a certain flow to the poem, so that there's actually an interesting dichotomy between the form imposed on this very troubling situation, the form of a recurring two-line stanza, and then the enjambment, the spilling over from one stanza to the next.
If you were just listening to it, you would not realize that it was written in poetic form.
Except that there's a condensation here of what it means to have Alzheimer's. Look at how he captures the horrific reality of Alzheimer's in just this little space, this brief space.
There is a phase in Alzheimer's when they look at themselves in the mirror and they don't know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know.
So that phrase, rapt erudition, an amazing phrase, it could almost be humorous or satiric or facetious, but I don't sense any humor here. I don't think he's making fun of this fellow. Yeah.
I thought the beginning. Go ahead.
Sorry. Now, I want to come back to the Vanessa Talisade's couple lines. And earlier on, when she asks him, "Harry, do you want coffee or tea?" she doesn't really allow him to make a decision. She then steps in and makes the decision for him. And I almost get the sense.
Wait a minute, because that italicized line, oh, give him tea, I think that comes from him.
Yeah, that comes from him. She dutifully, I got the impression that it was her just kind of stepping in and, like, you know, asking would he like coffee or tea, and while he's trying to figure it out, she just says, okay, we're going to give him tea.
I think you're picking up on the tone that Parsons is trying to establish here, where he says, Ruth, stately still, Roachly asks him in that wifely way. You get the sense of impatience, perhaps?
Well, yeah, and I think that's what you typically find with Alzheimer's. At some point, you just don't let them continue kind of making decisions. Your patience is gone, so
yeah.
You start doing things.
Yeah.
I think at the end, when I say he wants to come back, you know, he wants to come back and they won't let him. I'm almost seeing a conscious mind versus the unconscious mind of Harriet, who the unconscious is saying, you know, he's talking to the conscious mind that he wants to come back. The conscious Harriet, the one that makes decisions, the one that is the one like that he used to be, wants to come back, but now because he's slow in making decisions and doing things, they won't let him be the person he used to be. His friends, his family, they're holding him back from being who he ever always was, and that it's the unconscious that's saying these things about the conscious Harry. That's how I read the end, where it was a conversation between two entities, but it was both within his own mind, and that him was the conscious, and where they say he wants to come back, the unconscious is talking about the conscious part of Harry. That was the outward appearance that everybody associates. That's what people were holding back. And he still doesn't understand in his own mind that old Harry's not around anymore.
I haven't read anything about Alzheimer's where they differentiate the conscious and the subconscious. I'd be interested in that analysis because, you know, we're made up of about 90% of our subconscious or more, and the conscious is a very small part. But Alzheimer's to me is in the conscious.
I think that's what they're focusing on here, and that maybe the subconscious is still a little more rational, but it's not the one driving the action. The conscious is the only thing that drives the outward action. The subconscious can't act. But it can comment.
It does.
But
it's subconscious. It's in the conscious.
But it can act.
And just a comment here.
Well, I was reading that a different way, and that this is describing still another aspect of their life together. She drops back into a routine, broadly asking him, forgetting the situation. And then she says, then the realization,
right.
She has forgotten.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That he has this condition. That's what I was hearing.
So those two lines need to be read a little bit differently. Would you like tea or coffee, Harry? Harry, do you want tea or coffee? Something like that. Yeah.
And he doesn't answer, so then she wrote,
give him coffee.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Oh, so she's the one who says, oh, give him tea.
Right.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Because she realizes she's not going to get an answer.
I see.
It could be Ariana just speaking in the third person.
Yeah, but it could be her too, because that would fit the situation. So, well, he's not coming back. And it's not that his friends won't let him come back. Alzheimer's won't let him come back.
Right.
Right?
But in his own mind, he thinks he's being held back.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love the next and the last line, or the third line up. He whispers in that familiar, gentle, fatherly tone. Meaning, there's still some of him in there.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
He whispers.
There's still something familiar about him. I like
yes.
that.
Yes. And when you ask for his poetry, I think some of the lines are poetry, whether you look at it or not. It's the language you use, the words you choose sometimes. The small dark stall with its endless roll of blank white sheets of paper. That's not something you normally read just in a prose.
Right.
That's poetry. And I think the same thing's true with the alliteration in the second line from the top. As always, affably. You're getting that rhythm in there. And that's the tendency of a poet to write that way, not the tendency of someone who writes a novel. Mm-hmm. That's why I call it poetry.
So the images, the organization, the
choice of words.
Word choice. Yes, you should recognize this as a poem, even just listening to it orally.
Mm-hmm. I was really struck by the beginning where he says in the third little strophe, this cruel wound, he talks about a small void in our own understanding that Alzheimer's makes us wonder what we're forgetting too. And that was so poignant to me, and it just hit that fear. You know, that we all
When am I going to go?
Exactly.
You know?
And
yeah.
I thought that was done really powerfully and subtly. It's really nice.
Which makes it clear from the outset that he's not making fun of Harry.
Oh, no.
This is a very pathetic situation. It's poignant, and he's going to convey that to us. Yeah.
I just looked at this so differently. I spent 18 months visiting a nursing home when my parents were there and spent a lot of time on the Alzheimer's wing. And this to me is like you have the wife taking the husband out. Yeah, they're still doing things. But at the end, I heard so many times when I was there, you know, he wants to come back. He wants to come back home. You know, he wants to be home and not, you know, and they won't let him.
Well, you've just shed light on that phrase. Thank you very much, because that interprets it in a different way. Yeah. But then you do have to assume that he's in some facility. And he's been taken out.
Or maybe they're just in the community room and someone else is coming.
Okay.
To visit something, you know, and she's, it doesn't have to be out of that facility.
Yeah.
It's not,
yeah. Interesting. Yes?
It seems like you don't pick up that sort of dual personality or that two people thing. Still, the second page where he says, and respond, I am not really here, you know. Later, I accompany him to the men's room. I mean, he's suddenly got two. You've got two people here.
Yeah.
I mean, two. It's the same person, but I mean, I think that's what it means. It's not.
Well,
I don't think it's the lady speaking. It's because
it's the speaker.
Yes,
the speaker who's but the wife is not the speaker.
I have the impression it says now that we know that Harry has Alzheimer's, so this may be his wife and his daughter or a small group of friends or
Well, I think he's certainly alone in the restroom. And that's how I see it. And then he, when he comes later, I accompany him to the men's room. There's no I anywhere else in here. And so I think he's talking.
Well, wait a minute. There's a we at the very beginning.
Why?
I take the speaker as a friend of this couple.
Why?
So it's the speaker who goes with Harry to the restroom.
Me too.
You think?
I think so.
I don't think so. I think that's his first clue that he's talking to someone. And he's talking to himself in a way there. I mean, that's how I look at it.
I think the speaker takes him to the restroom because he knows he can't get to the restroom without him.
Yeah. And speaking of details that make it a poem, the detail he selects is Harry washes his hands first instead of last. That really sums it up, you know.
The whole experience.
Yeah.
Well, don't you do that?
Not yet.
They all have the mechanics way that you understand.
Yes.
Mechanics. Dirty hands, you wash first.
And then?
Then, yeah. Well, that's the term.
Next poem, Challenge Court. Page 6, handwritten page 6. And if this weren't poetry, we wouldn't be spending so much time talking about, about them.
Exactly. It wouldn't be easier to understand.
Okay, Challenge Court. In the Challenge Court, you have no set partner, and the matches come to you like blind dates with their many unexpected quirks, odd styles of service, surprise shots, and strange nuances that bring mystery and a certain edgy anticipation to every game. It is there that I often found him with his ex-Marine handshake and congenial look-you-in-the-eye smile before and after our play. He was the gentleman hunter. When you became his game, his style was a kind of stalking. I remember my old Austin friend and partner, Jim Sellers, with his awesome animal athleticism, relentlessly attacking the ball straight on with stunning velocity, as if it were some huge and lethal insect, swatting it time and time again, anticipating its geometric flight like some expert entomologist gone mad, most volleys ending in dramatic and resounding bottom-bore kill shots. Whereas Fred's style was as smooth and confident as his demeanor and his ageless pompadour, only with fisted waves, curls, and left hooks, deceptively deadly and yet not extreme, not like Captain Hook Reeve with his jaw-drop ball-hopping. Fred's way was subtle, like some cancer that after being diagnosed in the first prophetic shots brought predictable and deadly ends to the remaining volleys. That one such as he, with such control, was downed with that single shot to the heart is not ironic. There is no poetry to our loss. There is only the stillness of that quiet valve. The handball challenge court, waiting in the downtown YMCA, in the heart of Houston's tangle of arteries, and the question that comes to mind every time I now stoop through the small passageway to begin another challenge match. How could a totally empty 20 by 40 by 20 room with white walls seem more vacant? Now, there's a note at the end of the volume about this poem. It reads, "For Fred Copeland, lost to a heart attack at the Houston downtown YMCA, Court 10.
Oh.
So obviously this is from his personal experience with this fellow.
It also makes sense out the last line. So if you played Ragdoll, it's nothing
vacant
about it.
Yeah.
Except that explains, having that note there explains the last three lines.
Mm-hmm.
He's now back in the room.
But I don't think you need the note to get the poem. That sense of silence, that sense of absence, I feel that just reading the poem without the note. You needed the note?
Yes.
I didn't.
Yeah.
It's just a way to treat a memory.
father played golf every week with three buddies. And one by one, they would die until he was the only one that was going off to play. They never replaced the dead friend.
Oh.
And at the end, you know, he was off playing the rounds by himself.
Golf will do that to you.
Yes, it will. They didn't die in the golf course, but they were, you know. So, yeah, you have lots of memories and your friends die.
Yeah.
Wilhelm, you were going to say something.
No, I was thinking about other golfers. So, you know, so.
Okay.
At the swine lady, Jim says that's my impression of handball.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm feeling some analogy to the body here at the last, where he talks about the artery.
Oh, yeah.
And the valve.
And the loss.
Mm-hmm.
And the stillness.
So apparently that shot of the ball set off a heart attack. That's how I interpret it. Because of the note. I mean, I've said I don't need the note, but the note does help. It does help.
And you use cancer as another descriptor for how it came on. Like, even though it's a heart attack, he's using the cancer to show that it's kind of similar to the way the cancer would be coming on.
The inevitability of cancer.
And unexpected.
Yeah.
But, of course, the comparison here at the top of that second page is to the inevitability of the deadly nature of his shots.
Yeah, I love the way you use stalking, relentlessly attacking,
mm-hmm.
lethal insect, meaning, you know, here he comes.
I like his description of the different styles.
Kill
attacker is a smooth, confident one.
Yes.
Soccer. That's pretty much the way it goes in the racket world. You're one of those 30.
Or the one who approached it with awesome animal athleticism. That's great assonance right there.
Yeah.
Those A sounds. Awesome animal athleticism.
I consider myself lucky just to hit the stupid ball.
It's interesting that you direct attention to the different ways his friends played. I thought as I read this poem for the first time, that's what the agenda was going to be, just to somehow capture the uniqueness of his different companions. And then it became clear that that's not really the point of the poem. The point of the poem is to set all that up and then have it heighten the sense of absence, the sense of stillness at the end. So that made the poem even more effective for me, because I was expecting a study in variety of players, and what we get is a poem about silence.
The loss of a friendship.
Yeah,
but I mean, on the racquetball court, you may only meet them there once a week and for 30 minutes, but you get to know them real well.
Our next poem is Speechless. Handwritten page 8 in the handouts. More silence. Speechless. I found my father that late December morning as if he had just lain down to sleep, hands at his side, right hand holding his always present asthma spray, dull eyes seeming to ponder the tiles above, as if absently looking for familiar shapes to pass the time, like he taught us to do with the clouds on those long, infrequent West Texas road trips. He would take us for a week or so to allow Mother a summer break and help us to understand a rag salesman's life without having to actually speak. I found my mother after penning a poem, articulating the difficulty I had experienced writing about her. She was kneeling, dressed for bed, into her small, glowing bathroom tub that received her petite frame like a large porcelain seashell with its life half in, half out, her face pressed flat to the surface, as if she were listening to some astonishing sound, blush of crimson whispering from her mouth. Nothing in her entire life ever could keep her speechless.
Between the mother and father, how he is probably often speechless and she is never speechless. I like that.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
Well, she is now, but she isn't, because the way she's lying in that bathtub dead, for him, sums up her outspoken nature, that blood running out of her mouth.
Yeah.
So, studying contrasts.
I thought the two together were particularly poignant because in long marriages, the couple often die within a year of each other. My parents did. And I get that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Like first he died and then a year, well, however long.
We don't know. We don't know.
No, but it made me, reminded me, made me feel like that.
And he found both of them.
Yeah, he was the one who found it. It's a very loving poem.
You could imagine a satiric approach to each one of these characters, but obviously he's not doing that here. He's trying to get at their essence from the way he found them when they were dead.
Mm-hmm.
How interesting.
No, I understand that he's finding stuff at the first one. I'm kind of confused as to why he put the road trips in there.
Because that's his memory of his father.
Well, I mean, he's not talking about memories, he's talking about finding him passed away, not the road trip, some road trip.
Well, past the time in the car with back when. Going out through West Texas, what will you do with your children if you drop them alone? Teach them how to look at clouds and imagine what the clouds might be.
The road trip had nothing to do with finding a father.
It's just his memory.
In the bed.
It's a vacant stare of the eyes, uplifted, looking as you would look.
I'm hoping Dad didn't look like that while he was driving through West Texas.
He took his kids with him.
Right.
He was a traveling salesman. He took his kids with him so they'd have some sense of what his life was like, but he didn't do any talking. He didn't explain anything to them. He just brought them along so that they could observe.
Right.
So he's not the kind, he was a man of few words.
Yeah, he said in the difference between his father and mother. Mm-hmm. His father said nothing without having to actually speak.
His father said everything without ever. He said he was able to express himself.
He meant the other way. It's a contrast between the two.
Yes.
Yeah.
See it now? Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Notice the pattern of enjambment and caesura. His use of caesuras throughout. Caesura is a midline pause. It can be created through punctuation, and often is. So you have a very clear fixed form here, two stanzas, Dad on top, Mom on the bottom, and yet the rhythm of the poem snakes through this fixed form with an interesting rhythm to it. The spilling over from one line to another, or the enjambment, and the pauses in the middle of the line instead of only at the end of each line, it makes for an interesting poem. So in the absence of a fixed rhyme scheme, in the absence of a fixed meter, like iambic pentameter, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you have other ways of modulating the rhythm and the sound of the poem.
You changed the rhythm in the second stanza.
How so?
Well, half in, half out.
her face. Well, that's different rhythm than what West Texas Road Trips.
And do you think the rhythm has changed to fit the character?
I think you probably did that to fit the character.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
You know, as you're grappling with poetry on your own, reading out loud, you can't do without that. I can spend as long as I want just silently reading, and if I just open my mouth and read it out loud to myself, I see things. So it's amazing what reading out loud will show you. Let's move on to Feathering Deep. Page 9 on your handout, page 46 in the book. Feathering Deep, after Edward Hirsch's The Demon and the Angel. I believe it to be unlike any other conveyance, the manner in which it carries us in upon its own silence, the way an idea drifts into the gray divide where we find ourselves in that sacred state, easing quietly into the dark duende to unconscious understanding. A lone canoe at midnight, blades paddling deep, smoothly and deftly feathering that largest of bodies.
You know, one thing about poetry is that you do have the freedom to interpret it any way you want when you're reading it. And sometimes maybe our experiences influence how we interpret it. And anyway.
We certainly see that in this room, right? Because we're all bringing different things to the poem. A different style all of a sudden. Not the expansive, chatty style that we've seen in some of the other poems, but a very restricted, confined expression. The tone's completely different.
It's kind of sad poetry, everyone that we've read so far.
this isn't sad, this is just very tranquil. I mean, it's just, there's nothing sad about taking a nice, quiet, slow canoe ride out on a lake with your own thoughts. I mean, I find that very comforting and quieting.
The atmosphere is one of stillness and peace.
Yeah, nothing sad about it.
Why is the demon and the angel at the top?
Sad to me when you find your mother dead and your
family. Oh, yes. Oh, no. Oh, sure. That was right.
Why is the demon and the angel at the top?
Okay. Does anyone know Edward Hirsch? Of course, some of you must know him as a famous poet, I believe from Texas, actually. From Houston, if I recall. And he wrote a book called The Demon and the Angel. So let me share a little bit with you, because it is important for the poem. This is a summary of that book at Amazon. The Demon and the Angel, Searching for the Source of Artistic Inspiration. A work of art, whether a painting, a dance, a poem, or a jazz composition, can be admired in its own right. But how does the artist actually create his or her work? What is the source of an artist's inspiration? What is the force that impels the artist to set down a vision that becomes art? In this groundbreaking work, Edward Hirsch explores the concept of duende, that mysterious, highly potent power of creativity that results in a work of art. With examples ranging from Federico Garcia Lorca's Wrestling with Darkness, as he discovered the fountain of words within himself, to Martha Graham's creation of her most emotional dances, from the canvases of Robert Motherwell to William Blake's Celestial Visions, Hirsch taps into the artistic imagination and explains, in terms illuminating and emotional, how different artists respond to the power and demonic energy of creative impulse. So so this image of being in the canoe at midnight, all alone in darkness, no one else around, I take that as a metaphor for the state you need to be in to get in touch with the duende. Does that work for you?
Yeah, there's no distractions of the world going on. Until you get to that meditative, quiet state, now you can let that subconscious and your thoughts and just the creativity now can come to you where it was kind of over, you know, all the noise and distractions going on never allowed your consciousness to feel, you know, this inspiration and the output of your subconscious.
So in order to get in touch with that duende, you need to be in a state of mind. You need to go to a certain place, so to speak, where you can get in touch. Now, feathering, what does feathering mean?
That's the way you handle that paddle, where you do not make a splash. But I will tell you something. This is Dave's way of doing it. There are poets that do it by drugs. There are poets that do it by alcohol. There are people poets that do it other ways. I do it from an emotional standpoint. When something really touches my emotion, that's when I write the award-winning poetry. And it's not a quiet place. It's a place where I see something that was done to somebody that was not right. And regardless of what that situation was, it brings up an anger in me, which then translates into some good poetry. So I think every poet has something that kicks them over the edge to that place in their head where you no longer write it. You start writing it.
Yeah.
And it writes itself.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's only a word or a sentence that you read or hear that triggers a poem, or I think it is.
Yeah.
Or a couple of words together that you haven't seen that way before.
I think for a lot of us, right as we wake up in the morning, is where we have a lot of the creativity, where we get up and then go write. You're just quiet, still, and I'm sure you're like I am. There's a lot of people that's the point where, boy, there's some really good stuff going on, and you just let it happen. You try not to fully wake up and let your consciousness completely take over. You just experience as it's coming into your consciousness. Then once you become fully awake, then you can get up and go in and get it down.
Yeah.
But there's only a small percentage of our population that do that.
But they actually get up and do it.
I think about it. I want to go back to my dream sometime. I don't even want to get up.
I want to know what he's doing on the lake at midnight.
I was wondering.
I didn't say night, I said midnight.
Yes, but you
way
see,
too light.
Yeah, the creative folks among us, the ones who go out in that canoe at midnight or whatever it takes, you know, to get in touch with the duende, the rest, everyone else is saying, look at that crazy guy, you know.
Of course, I get caught.
I'm actually on the phone calling the hospital.
Of course, I get caught in what he used to convey the quietness. And that is the prolongation sounds, the ends, the oohs, the long vowels are used to convey this quiet continuance of silence.
Excellent.
Notice that these lines kind of float on the page as if you were in that canoe at midnight. There's very little punctuation.
What if you haven't never been in a canoe?
I'm sorry?
What if you've never been in a canoe?
Consider yourself lucky.
Well, but you may have seen how quietly a canoe can glide through the still waters.
See, I see the space between each of these as the stroke with the paddle.
You forgot to feather. So feathering is when after you pull through the water, you turn the oar so that the blade is parallel to the water and the wind doesn't catch it.
Right.
I understand. Now you put these spaces in there, the spaces are from the poem.
Yes.
So that's what I'm seeing is the oar in the water in those spaces.
Okay.
Between those lines.
I like that. Feathering deep. Okay, let's look at fire. Page 10 on your handouts, 47 in the book. Now, this is written in response to a painting, a famous painting by Gustave Courbet called Yo, La Belle Irlandaise, Joanna Hifferman. I will put it on the screen.
Oh, nice.
Does anyone know this painting? There it is.
Usually does landscapes. I've never seen that. I think it's gorgeous.
At first glance, Joanna Hifferman appears to be brushing her stunning long red hair filling the frame as it forms her looming intense face, where dazzling blue eyes blaze into a handheld silver mirror as the other hand toils at fiery ringlets, petite fingers pulling gently from atop the creamy painting of brow above the magnetic passion of those eyes drawing the looks of the crowded queue, all gawking like the awed bystanders watching some grand building aflame. Their attention keeps returning to the two small windows where humanity might emerge, showing its true face, some emotion like fear, despair, desire, lust, emotions they might all recognize within themselves or their outed longings, all standing like worshippers before some magnificent cardinal saint, like Joan herself, burning, flaming, inside and out, all present, blessed with fire.
That's Joan of Arc.
I would think so, yes.
I'm sorry, I just see her going like, damn, I got another snarl.
That's a haiku and a short point.
You raise an interesting point, because if you don't see what Parsons sees in this famous painting, it's okay. This is an exercise in ekphrastic poetry. Ekphrastic poetry is a poem about a work of art, typically a painting. Poets who do this feel free to imagine all kinds of things, you know, and to give verbal expression to what cannot be put in words in the original work of art itself. James Hoggard has a series of poems called the Edward Hopper poems, and he takes famous paintings by Hopper and explores things about those paintings that I would never think of just by looking at those paintings. You know, he goes off in some strange directions with what he says about those poems. But that's just part of the ekphrastic exercise. You can make of a painting whatever you want. It might say more about you than the painting, but that's okay.
More about her hair.
The term is ekphrastic. E-K-P-H-R-A-S-T-I-C.
E-K-P-H-R-A-S-T-I-C.
There's actually a couple ways to spell it.
E-K-P-H-R-A-S-T-I-C.
Okay, I got it.
I would have never won the spelling bee, but if I can write it down.
I took a course on it, so I know. That's the only way I know how to spell it.
Ekphrastic. So a poem about another work of art, typically a painting.
I'm kind of struck by this. He gets all of this out at the first glance. And applying to me, there's a lot more there if you take time and study and think about it. This is just the first glance reaction.
Now, the setting, I think, is a museum. These people that he's referring to, they're the people who have stopped at this painting to gaze upon it. And the two windows, it's her eyes.
I don't understand his fascination. I mean, to me, maybe it's just not too far away, but the magnetic passion of her eyes, the eyes drawing the looks of the crowd, and Hugh all gawking at to see the expression in her eyes, and I don't think the eyes are the most... the first thing that you see.
Obviously, this is not a faithful reproduction, is it? Okay, he gets carried away, but they sometimes do in ekphrastic poetry. It's okay.
But
so
he does go in there, and he talks about what they see coming through the windows. He talks about the different emotions. So she, you know, theoretically, yeah, that she's sitting there thinking about what I got to do today, or do I really love this guy? Am I going to get dressed?
But we don't really know a lot about her. She's kind of...
So everybody fills it in for themselves.
She's kind of a Mona Lisa figure, because he doesn't tell us what's really going on inside of her. He can't. He can't know.
He painted her. He better know.
No, he...
He's the Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
To me, she looks a little, maybe soul-searching. Maybe a little troubled.
Meditative.
Maybe kind of looking, trying to look into her own soul is what I see.
Mm-hmm.
When
she's looking
like
she's
without a
haircut. Yeah, me too. I think she's deciding whether to cut her hair. Really, that looks like she's already started down there on the bottom. That's what it looks like to me.
Notice the way the repetition of the word hair and eyes works. Second line. Her stunning long red hair filling the frame, just that simple repetition from the end of the line to the beginning of the next line helps emphasize what he's trying to bring out in his painting. And then down a little bit, above the magnetic passion of those eyes drawing the looks of the crowded queue. Simple but effective. Take note, Hollis.
Well, I think about this ekphrastic forms, and I don't know that we even get a clue of what the artist that was painting the picture was doing. All we're doing is reacting to what we see.
It's an excuse to get poetry out of something, some stimulation.
That's right.
That's all it is.
That's all.
And this one got a little wordy.
Did Joan of Arc cut her hair?
I don't know.
Did she cut her hair?
Oh, maybe so.
To me, I just remember having short hair.
I think you're right.
But she looks very much like the way he describes his wife in the first.
Yes. So that mysterious essence that a man can't ever tap into. Let's look at figures, page 11, handwritten page 11. And page 76 in the book.
I have a question. If all of this had ended at the same spot, could it be called proto-portrait?
What do you mean, ended at the same spot?
Well, proto-line.
Justify it right now.
Everybody ends at the same spot.
You mean if it's right and justified?
Yeah, right and left justified, so it is literally a square.
Yeah.
Most prose poems are.
Could it be called prose poetry then?
I have to turn back and look at it so I can see what you're trying to get at.
Well, generally a response poem to something that exists.
Yeah, I think if it responds to a photograph, a painting, or something that you see, it would be better termed ekphrastic.
So are you asking if it were right justified?
It would be a prose poem.
No, it'd be a poem. I know what a prose poem is, though. A prose poem is typeset so that it looks like a paragraph.
Right.
But here there's obviously a deliberate strategy of lineation. All right, let's move on to figures. Page 76 in the book and page 11 in the handout. Figures for Jean Antill, 1935 to 2012. When you walked into HISD's Contemporary Learning Center, a fancy name for your last chance, and found yourself in Mr. Jean Antill's class, perhaps it was your first real chance, because when you found your face in the light of Mr. Antill's visage, under those kind and twinkling eyes full of joie de vivre, you soon discovered that he knew you already, that you were from the world of figures, figures like dropout rates, learning disabilities, low test scores, and badass street bullies, drugs, figures of missing dads and single moms with worn, worried expressions and no answers to the figures that you have been unable to figure out. So here you are in Mr. Antill's room, and you soon learn that here is a man who truly knows something about the world of the numerous figures, and here is a figure of a man like no other, an individual that has figured out most all those difficult figures the hard way by trial and error, and here is a man that still, after years of figuring, loves to figure the figures, a man whose infectious joy for living a life in the world of figures radiates a hope that you can figure it out too. And he looks straight through you and sees nothing but the possibilities of your figuring it out, for he sees the truth you have always held hidden in deep in your gut, and his easy figuring of and for you can only be translated into two figures, faith and love.
Wow. What a beautiful tribute to the teacher. Now, why did you read so fast?
The poem calls for it, I think.
Did that work for you?
Yeah, I think the poem calls for it. It's like too many words. You had to read this slow, you'd have got bored by the fifth line. By reading it fast, you kind of held into the poem, so I think you did a great job.
I was almost going for a certain rap style. That didn't work for you?
Yeah, we got that repetition of figures.
Yes.
I get the feeling this is kind of a visual indication of just the population of students that have been through his class. This thing is just year after year after year of these figures, students coming through his class. Mm-hmm. And that's how repetitious his teaching life has been. And he still approaches it in a very...
With love and compassion. Mm-hmm. So he gets all the losers, but he doesn't treat them like losers. He treats them... He approaches each one with faith that there's something salvageable within them. Those of us who are teachers, what an inspirational poem, right?
It's HISD, is that Houston Independent?
I assume so. Yeah.
He likes the word figures, though.
But he is using different meanings, different.
And I think that's creative the way he figured on figures.
There are many different meanings of the word figures, and he's playing upon those different meanings.
Well, I like the way he's using it up on the top where it's a quantitative measurement, but down on the bottom part is an inner measurement of the person.
Yeah. A very, very different poem from all the others we've looked at.
Very different.
I think it rounds out the collection very nicely.
Well, the use of the figures with Headingly kind of is the pulse that keeps you, it's kind of like, not plot is not the word, but it's kind of, you know, he's kind of hit with this time after time after time. And he's just using the word figures, because figures keeps you, it's like a pulsing time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's how teachers can deal with this with figures, because they get, I've got this many students, and they tell you every year, well, you're going to have this many that graduate, this many that drop out. You know, that's the teacher's world. It's just like every year, it's here's your numbers. And at the end of the year, here's your numbers, and they're all the same always.
But he doesn't see figures, he sees real human beings and what's the potential in each one.
I had a friend of mine that was a teacher. teacher up north, and he said the first day of class, what he always did, he had a little envelope with card, and he, after they came in and sat down, he says, okay, and opened them up, and he says, okay, who's got the drug dealer? Who's got the, you know, criminal? And all of them were poets, scientists. He says, this is what I expected. You know, he never looked at it necessarily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Any other comments on this poem?
Excellent.
It's an extended riff on the word figures.
Now, what did they call this word? Where it was like almost one continuous line where he just kept using the parentheses instead of, you know, a period of stopping it.
I'm not following your question.
Like you said, you were reading it really fast. Like I asked you, reading it really fast because the work really stops to it.
Yeah. Notice that it's one long sentence.
Yeah.
I mean, there's.
Right. Is that a style or? Is something?
Oh, Faulkner.
Is that stream of consciousness?
Stream of consciousness, kind of, I suppose. But this is carefully structured and organized, which stream of consciousness usually isn't, because the whole point of the stream of consciousness technique is to capture the rawness of an interior state. So I wouldn't quite call this stream of consciousness. But I do want to direct your attention to something that a student pointed out to me. There's actually a rhetorical term for what Parsons is doing with the word figure. And it is antanaklasis, if I've pronounced it correctly, A-N-T-A-N-A-C-L-A-S-I-S, antanaklasis. Definition from the freedictionary.com is a rhetorical device in which the same word is repeated, but with a different sense each time.
You have students that knew that word?
Yes. It's amazing what students will give you. So,
is it true that I'm going to figure that out? Is that a phrase that's more Texas or more southern than the rest of the nation?
Well, you're asking a northerner.
did you say that as a kid? I'm going to figure that
yes,
out.
Yes, sure. Oh, yeah. I don't think it's a southernism.
You say I'm fixing dough?
I do not.
Now that's the South.
All right, our next poem. Stepdaughter, handout, page 12, handwritten page 12, book page 64. The term has always felt clumsy in my mouth, not unlike the relationship at its beginnings. The tangle of diverse families that creates these awkward first hugs, so full of the fire of mixed emotions, histories. I remember the first time I was struck full face by the joyful blue-green eyes that were plumed in that small face, surrounded by the shock of blondish brown hair, a stunning mane that seemed much too substantial for a child's head, redolent of the thick, lush texture of the mother's hair, that I remembered hurriedly brushing those early school mornings into shiny, bouncing dog ears, stunning locks in complicated snares and rats, demanding gentle concentration, occasionally evoking a snagging yelp and pain reflected in those eyes, distinctive, subtly different from her mom's, yet with the same unusual, mesmerizing qualities. Those first blurring years were the times the awkward nature of the term was truly onomatopoetic of the relationship, countless hard encounters of miscommunications and cobbling of minds and wills, and then euphoric discoveries, selfless moments, genuine feelings of family. The years have passed, and like roots grown in buried tangles under a grand old oak tree, all those complicated nerve endings, so raw from being torn from their original bodies, have found their ways to firm new ground. Rich loam, stepdaughter, the term, as in introductions, still does not feel correct to my dumb tongue. My daughter, Two smooth syllables combed together as two pigtails woven carefully around each other naturally. I would like you to meet my lovely daughter, Laura.
Well, he hit the nail on the head because stepdaughter is a word that I never use.
And you have a stepdaughter?
Yes. I call her a daughter. I don't have to call her. I agree with him. The term is, it doesn't sound right. There's got to be a better term for that relationship.
It's that, yeah. A step has kind of a harsh sound to it.
Yes, it does.
It's like you're separating yourself, saying, mm-hmm. you know, this is not my real child. Mm-hmm.
It's a step away, yeah, for real.
My wife never calls my daughter stepdaughter either. She calls her Kathy, her daughter.
There's an interesting evolution here. He resists the term at the outset, talks about the awkwardness of the relationship, and then finally there's an evolution towards the word daughter.
It pretty much describes what happens to
the progression in this poem. Corresponds to the progression in that relationship, in that family, over time. The title is interesting in the sense that it represents what he resisted, the term that he resisted.
That when she was really young, it was his stepdaughter. Sounds like they had some tumultuous times.
Absolutely.
You know, at the onset.
Do you see how in the final stanza the pigtail imagery fits with earlier in the poem?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wonder if the
pulling and the yawns and pain. Snares and rats at first.
Let's look at another poem, My Previously Owned Son, page 13 in your handouts, page 78 in the book. And the epigraph is from a group called The Police. I'll Be Watching You, famous song. Like me and most of the men I know, he would wish his poem to have a glib, self-effacing title, something deflecting, as we all usually redirect any angst that life might have or will befall us with humor, and what your many psychoanalyst family members would term stuffing it, and for him, in the body of the piece, there must certainly be a musical reference of some deep and meaningful nature. After all, it is surely the sublime timbers of his mind that have truly defined the essence of the young man, and travel, perhaps a large ship, though not the Aggie one, where he spent his first summer at sea, in searching himself and other strange geographies, a discoverer. Yet for him, it has always been about revelations. For the man I have been watching since the year of his 10th birthday, when I first met full face that smiling Dutch boy look of promise, pure raw hope and a palpable trust, despite all that he had witnessed in his small version of the world. Years later, I remember a face grown twice as old in a hospital bed, the heart tests, and we having been told by the doctor must inform him of his grave and hopeless condition. And as we did so, with our parents' acute agony, that same face stared back at us with complete disbelief, saying, "Oh, that's bullshit. No way, no way." And by day's end, we learned, yes, in some miraculous way, the heart had begun to recover as if willed so by the sheer power of his irrepressible hope, inexplicably creating his own realities. And now, after all these many years of watching, I know that my son's heart is a unique instrument of music with its own rhythms, and it is also a kind of boat that carries him and those he loves, lifting any one of life's many voyagers that find themselves on his way, illuminating them a turn of notion, a portal to some strange joy that was a traveling embryonic melody within the sacred valves of their own crafting of reality.
Best love poems I've ever
heard. Yes. So a tribute to his son, a tribute to his wife, a tribute to his stepdaughter.
What's that previously on? I don't get that. Well, he said he'd been watching over them since the year, since his 10th birthday.
So he's adopted.
Another adopted. Yeah. And then it's another way to say adopted.
Yes.
I adopted
him for his stepchild's
10th birthday. I guess so.
Or maybe he's a stepson.
But he's giving this boy up. He's letting the boy wander off into life, not clinging to him.
And that's
where I think the epigraph
to
Sting comes in, because I looked up the lyrics to that song. You'll recognize it when you hear it, but the song itself is kind of creepy.
It is.
You know, here's some lines. Oh, can't you see you belong to me? She's left him. And, you know, can't you see you belong to me? How my poor heart aches with every step you take. Since you've gone, I've been lost without a trace. I look around, but it's you I can't replace. And on and on and on. I think today we would maybe look upon those lyrics a little differently than when they first came out.
Right.
But isn't it interesting what gets people's attention? It was an extremely popular song, you know, and it's funny how those songs people never really listen to the lyrics and think about the lyrics. Like Jimi Hendrix, Foxy Lady, if you look at the lyrics to Foxy Lady, they're kind of troubling, you know, so be careful about those crowd pleasers. The lyrics might be questionable. In any case, I think there's some interesting intertextuality here. We've talked about intertextuality before. He is offering a different version of I'll be watching you. Not I'll be watching you in a creepy way because I can't let go of you. I'll be watching you because I'm your father and I'm letting go so that you can head out into the world and be your own man. But I'll be watching you proudly, not in a clinging, unhealthy way. Do you agree with me that there's an inversion here?
Yes.
So often when a poet uses an epigraph from some other literary text, it's not to say the same thing. It's to say something very different. And often it's an inversion. It's the opposite, to explore the opposite side of the matter.
Could this also be for a stepson? I mean, from his 10th birthday. You would think a father would watch his son from very early. Here it starts the 10th birthday.
Yeah.
So it could be a stepson.
Could be. Our last poem, I'll just leave you with that. You can go off and enjoy it on your own. It's about the time he ran into Lyndon B. Johnson by mistake. A humorous poem, much to the shock of the Secret Service agents who were guarding Lyndon B. Johnson. Do you want to take a quick look at it? Let's do that. We're supposed to get a PA announcement now that it's time to go home.
They're asleep.
Okay, so Nighthawk, page 15 in your handout, page 38 in the book. Congress Avenue rolls south from the Paramount Theater straight through centuries of live oak over the Colorado River before it was a lake, over that first main bridge before it housed the dark cloud of bats, and past the flagship Nighthawk restaurant, where I remember running head to chest into President Lyndon Johnson as his Secret Service agents, holding the glass doors open, looked on in horror at the unexpected possibilities of our collision. As I swung into the double doors like some unexpected and inescapable event in Asia, from the snaky nook of the restroom corridor, unaware of his incoming entourage, excuse me, no, pardon me, For a brief moment, we did that uncertain dance to squeeze by each other in the small vestibule of the double-door entry. LBJ, in trapped composure, I imagine, with steak or a beer on his mind. I, in awkward and puzzled wonderment. Secret Service agents on the outside and inside doors, staying stiffly cool, sizzling. Now, fortunately, the Secret Service has gotten its act together, and they don't let anything like this ever happen.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I was standing at the bottom of the stairs at A&M one time at a student conference, and LBJ was speaking. And he came down the stairs, and the Secret Service went, "You need to move," to me.
Yeah.
And I went, "Oh, what?" You know. And I was captured, so I can see.
You can relate to this.
Really,
yes. Yes. All right.
I'll give away my book.
Yes, we have an extra copy of the volume from which tonight's poems were taken. You are donating this.
I'm donating this.
To the group.
To the group.
How are we giving it away?
You write a number down on a piece of paper, and everybody tells you a number. Whoever gets closest to the number you write, from 1 to 30,
okay,
gets the book.
Okay.
That's the only fair way to do it.
My number from 1 to 30?
Yeah, but we can't see the number. We can see it over here. You better be careful.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Have your attention, please. The library will close in
25
minutes.
Now, also, since we're reading Dave Parsons,
I would ask
that if you get the book, take the cover off and let's read. We have time. Let's read The Color of Mourning, and we'll ask you to read it.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to read it.
What more than one person has the same number?
Well, then those two will have to guess again. He'll put another number there.
Okay.
We'll do that at the end. I've got my number. Before I let you go, I need to just say thank you all for coming. You're a great group to work with. We're having a lot of fun this season. And I look forward to next month with the poetry of Walt McDonald. And then finally, a month after that, we'll finish with poems by Texas Poet Laureate Jan Seale. Thanks, of course, to the Denton Public Library for giving us this space and the support. Thanks to Fred, who was with us for the first time this evening. Thanks as well to Recycled Books, Records, CDs, Cooper's Copies and Printing. Please take your business to Cooper's. They've been wonderfully supportive of us. Thanks to Vortman's. And thanks, of course, to Humanities Texas, which is giving us a fourth year of support. They've been trying to get rid of us for several years now, and we're finally saying goodbye so that they can allocate their money to other worthy groups. Hope to see you all next month. Help yourselves to the refreshments on the way out, please. Make sure I get my sign-up sheet back. It's over there. And again, if you can put one of our posters somewhere, please do that. So, farewell.
Numbers?
Okay, so who wants this volume?
Five?
13.
25.
21. You can only answer one time, though.
No.
Okay.
Any other guesses?
17.
3. 16.
The number was 13. It's written right here.
Okay. Open it up. So that's all I ask of you. So he can read the color, or you, but you can read The Color of Mourning.
The Color of Mourning, okay.
He's got it right here.
Page 28. The Color of Mourning.
The Color of Mourning. She awakened to the Texas summer bright in her eyes. Throwing on a new yellow robe, she dragged her body into the kitchen to make coffee, which she hung from the deep yellow decanter. Awareness steeps through the heart, beating pearls. Her eyes fall on the child's drawing that was tucked on the refrigerator door, a yellow duck swimming on deep, dark water under another bloody sun brimming with amber iris, goddess of the rainbow, adding to the litany of golden messengers, all bringing to her mind the yellow dress. The yellow dress that she had been given that she had given to her niece for her fifth birthday. The sweet lemon yellow dress that the child delighted in so that today she was to be buried in it. The sanctuary of summer kitchen felt unusually cold as she cracked a single egg, spilling carefully the delicate yolk onto melting butter, thinking, yellow, yellow, yellow should not feel like this.